It's about domestic politics in the U.S. driving foreign policy. I think that's how the rest of the world is going to see this by and large.
Welcome to Foreign Policy. I'm Ben Pauker, FP's executive editor for The Web, and you're listening to the ER. I'm in Washington today, and I'm joined by Colin Kahl, who's a co-editor of FP's Shadow Government blog with Julie Smith and Derek Chollet. He's currently a professor at Georgetown University's School of Foreign Service in the Security Studies program. Also joining us today is Dan DeLuce, FP's national security correspondent. And calling in from London is FP's Europe editor, Alicia Whitmire. ER nerds, if you have any questions or comments, you can email us at erpodcast@foreignpolicy.com. Recently, in our tiny podcast studio, high above Washington's DuPont Circle, we had the following conversation. So I'm so pleased to have our little confefe here, a small group of people who know exactly what the president is talking about.
Always,
right?
And I think it's pronounced confif.
Confif? Maybe that's just the European pronunciation. So in about 3 hours' time, President Donald Trump is scheduled to walk out into the Rose Garden and give a pronouncement on the Paris Accords, which is the 190-nation agreement on carbon reductions that the U.S. under Barack Obama's administration has signed on to. So it's a little bit odd. We don't know exactly what he's going to say, but this is clearly the news of the day. Colin, if he pulls out, is it a terrible deal for the United States? What does this look like around the world?
Well, I think from the perspective of U.S. leadership, it's catastrophic. We championed this deal. We really brokered it bilaterally, first with the Chinese, and then expanded it to include the entire globe. I think that it would signal to the world a certain degree of moral abdication, that the United States doesn't care about our children and our children's children, since climate change, according to the consensus of scientists, is one of the few truly existential challenges that we face, and that we just don't care about that. I think it would also question our credibility, given that we marshaled the world and galvanized the world to address this challenge and now have walked away from it. It would suggest, I think, that our politics can make such rapid swings that the United States can't be trusted. I think that could have some lasting damage. I think that it could send some complicating signals to markets and therefore position us poorly to be able to kind of stay on the cutting edge of technology that will be relevant for manufacturing moving forward. The statistic everybody talks about is that, you know, there are 76,000 people involved in the coal industry. There are 550,000 people involved in the solar industry just in California. It's those industries that will define the American economy going forward. And last but not least, we know from Secretary Mattis on down that the Pentagon, when they look at the national security challenges that we're likely to face in the 21st century, climate change is right up at the top. So it's also an abdication of our leadership on those issues.
You were in the administration. We didn't mention this in your very short bio, but you served as deputy assistant to the president, national security advisor to the VP. I mean, you must have been involved in some level of these negotiations for the Paris Accords. How difficult was it to get buy-in from the various agencies of government to actually ink this deal to begin with?
Yeah, I mean, I would say largely a spectator to this. It was really people in the White House like Brian Deese or people before that like John Podesta. Secretary Kerry played a huge role. But no, it was an enormous effort. It was something that the president came in 2009, committed to show leadership on this issue. And it's something that built across the first 6 years of the administration, really culminating in Paris. So it was hurting a lot of cats. And really, I think the approach was really to build up from a set of bilateral understandings, especially with China, given the outsized role that they play as the world's leading greenhouse gas emitter, and that is only going to go up and up given Chinese economic growth and development. So really locking that in as kind of the cornerstone of our bilateral engagement with China, and then building out from that. So this would be unwinding quite an extraordinary diplomatic effort, and I think doing grave damage to us in Europe, Asia, and elsewhere.
But China has already said, I think, was it this morning, that they are going to stick with the Paris Accord agreement. They are not pulling out. You know, this is a strategic play on the part of the Chinese. Their solar, you know, production is enormous. They have made significant attempts to curb pollution, to shut down coal plants, to push a green energy future. So, I mean, how does this play out with the U.S.-China relationship?
Well, I think it comes down to this, what Colin is saying, this kind of abdication. So it's if there's any illustration of the U.S. turning inward, I think it's this. And if you combine it with how Trump has approached a bunch of other issues. The U.S. is either absent or incoherent and very kind of protectionist on trade, kind of standoffish about NATO. So I think a lot of U.S. allies in Europe and Asia are sort of taking – it is about taking matters in their own hands now. I think they feel like they have to fill this vacuum. And so you see that in this joint statement, China and the EU talking about carrying on the effort against climate change. There's another irony here, too. You talk about the genesis of the agreement. If you remember, the Kyoto Protocols were criticized by a lot of people on the right, a lot of conservatives saying, you know, these are binding, really restrictive kind of measures, and it's limiting our freedom of action. So in a way, the Paris Agreement was very much kind of addressing those concerns that the Bush administration had way back when. And so this was voluntary. So in many ways, it was very much along the lines that a lot of conservative voices had called for. So there's an irony there. And then one last thing, I think also how the rest of the world perceives this, it's about domestic politics in the U.S. driving foreign policy. I think that's how the rest of the world is going to see this by and large, right? Because you have corporations pleading with the White House not to do this. You even have some coal companies asking them not to do this. So who really is going to be served by this or really is going to applaud this? And it's going to be the domestic base that supports the president.
And just to add to what Dan and Colin were saying, you know, I did a sort of quick perusal through various news, European news outlets this morning, just to get a sense of how it was being covered here. And this is obviously an unscientific sampling, but the way that it was being covered was overwhelmingly actually less about the material effects of the U.S. pulling out of the Paris agreements. And there's sort of some debate about, you know, what the sort of effects will be and whether there's so much momentum happening at the local and the business level that, you know, this isn't a big deal materially. You know, I don't want to play it down. But my point here is that the way that we're writing about it was very much focused on this as a signal about the U.S.'s role in the world. You know, this is a demonstration of Trump's unreliability, his irresponsibility, international agreements or commitments that should be taken seriously. So that's really been the primary response over here. So I think they're definitely right.
Just one last point I want to make about China, which is one of the interesting things that we saw during the transition was that the Trump officials, when they talked about the national security challenges that we faced, they basically said, yeah, ISIS is the wolf closest to the shed, right? It's the near-term challenge. But the medium and long-term challenge is the economic competition and the geopolitical competition with China. And what's so interesting is that they've bent over backwards basically to create a circumstance in which China is eating our lunch across the board. I mean, right before inauguration, Xi speaks at Davos and basically says that China is ready to take over the mantle of global leadership. Then one of the first thing that Trump does is pull out of the TPP, which basically clears the table for China to, in essence, negotiate its own regional trade agreement that'll work to the disadvantage of U.S. interests and our workers. And now with Paris, China, you know, is immediately trying to fill the void to try to cozy up with the Europeans. And so there's just a lot of own goals here as it relates to, you know, something that the Trump administration claims that they care about, which is the long-term competition with China.
I mean— is this just playing to Dan? You said, you know, Trump's political base. I mean, are we seeing that this is the influence of Bannon and the populists, you know, playing a political game? Clearly, Trump wants wins, right? He wants to renegotiate contracts, whether it's NAFTA. He pulls out of the TPP. He signs a deal with Vietnam, right? These are small. This was yesterday, when the president was in town. But you know, is this just Trump trying to play a game here?
Well, of course, I don't think the White House would say that. and you know, there are people, there are voices in the fossil fuel industry lobby who will support this or defend this. But I think it is telling that basically corporate America urged the White House not to do this.
Right. Even now, ExxonMobil, Goldman Sachs, there were letters to the president.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And we should also keep in mind that however they come down on the agreement, and let's say they stay in it with like massive objections and changing all the goals, they've already pursued an agenda on energy and the environment separate from this that is very much rejecting the whole idea of how to combat climate change. It's about, you know, getting rid of greenhouse emissions, you know, reducing them, scrapping them altogether, you know, trying to kind of revive the coal industry. So however they were going to come down on the Paris Agreement, they had already kind of shown where they were going on this. And there is this school of thought. I don't know if Dick Cheney still subscribes to it, but it is this kind of drill, baby, drill idea that, you know, rejecting basically climate change science and saying that, you know, we're going to put our chips on, you know, the here and now, and we're not going to make our calculations based on longer-term environmental effects.
Sure, and Trump has already rolled back restrictions on Arctic drilling. There's restrictions on rollbacks on, you know, federal lands. But I want to come back to the China thing. We've got Secretary of Defense James Mattis is headed to the Shangri-La Dialogue, which is a big confab of world leaders, of the top military officials from all over the world. And, you know, China's right at the center of this. This is in China's backyard. And, you know, somehow North Korea seems to be the issue that he cares about most of all. We had B-1 overflights over the Korean Peninsula. We had the somewhat telling shoot down of an ICBM, which clearly seemed to elicit a response from Pyongyang. I'm just wondering, you know, the Korean issue seems so front and center in the president's mind. Colin, do you see any traction there? Is it a possibility that we can actually see a deal, or is this just tough guy bluster?
No. It's interesting because, you know, I made a reference to the transition earlier. When they talked about China during the transition, they talked about it largely in terms of the economic war. That's the
right.
language they
this
use.
Currency manipulator.
Exactly. But, you know, and there was a concern before that they would basically prioritize the economic, the currency, the trade issues at the expense of the geopolitical concerns and interests that we had with the Chinese. And what they've done is they flipped the script on that. That essentially because, you know, Obama told Trump the number one national security issue you're going to confront in 2017, 2018, the first 2 years of the administration is North Korea and the possibility that they're edging closer to field testing an ICBM, which is a game changer as it relates to our extended deterrent relationship in East Asia. So you're going to have to deal with this. So you had the administration come in a sense, manufacture a crisis. And that I'm not actually... I'm not saying they made it up. I'm saying that they took behavior that North Korea was doing in terms of missile tests and they put it on the front burner and called attention to it in order to create a sense of crisis to put pressure on China to solve the problem for the United States. And you see this through Trump's tweets going back months, but periodically he'll wake up at 8 o'clock in the morning and basically say, you know, North Korea just launched a missile. That's very bad for China. They need to solve this problem. And in essence, he's willing to back away from some of the trade and currency stuff now if China just solves this problem for us. The question that I have there's no answer to is if what they're hoping to do is that Kim Jong-un is just going to cry uncle and that he's just going to agree to denuclearize, that he's going to capitulate, and that is somehow a precondition for us sitting down, that's never going to happen. This is his ace in the hole as it relates to regime survival, and he's really close to having an ICBM that could potentially deliver a nuclear weapon to the continental United States. He's not going to stop in the absence of not only tremendous pressure, but some face-saving way out. And so that is what I don't know is whether Rex Tillerson and whoever is wandering around the halls at the State Department actually has a plan for a negotiation and its face-saving way out, or whether they're completely farming that out to China. And if they are farming it out to China, then I can imagine that President Xi is trying to think up a way in which President Trump can maybe even meet Kim Jong-un at some point to work out the ultimate deal on North Korea. But if they're not willing to give something on the North Korean issue, they're not just going to get the regime to cry uncle.
No, those Trump tweets are very telling, actually, because it's clearly a way of trying to protect himself and themselves if this does, because they're setting themselves up for failure, right? They're setting a pretty high expectation that they're going to solve the Gordian knot here. They're going to solve this North Korean problem. And there's no new plan here. There are no new options. It's the same options that several administrations have faced. And I think I would invite any listeners out there, I would like to know, because I can't find anyone to tell me inside the State Department, inside the administration, in Congress, anywhere, that China is actually ready to change fundamentally its calculation. They see North Korea in a completely different way than we do. They're worried about different things like the collapse in the North Korean regime and so on. And so I don't see how a little bit of transactional dealing on Trump's part about, okay, well, I'm not going to hit you hard on this trade issue, is somehow going to, you know, change everything in Beijing. I think Beijing is waiting this out, and they're just going to see when the Trump administration basically just kind of loses interest.
Yeah, I mean, there might not be any new cards to play, but it certainly doesn't look like the strategic patience policy of the Obama administration. I mean, to me, it's the ratcheting.
Rhetorically, at least, yeah.
Yeah, of course. But, you know, I think, Colin, you bring up a great point. There's the ratcheting up of tensions, which theoretically, in a sort of perfect world, could provoke a response from China or push the North Koreans to do something. But Trump isn't the kind of guy that likes to give people a face-saving way out, does he? He likes to bully people so it seems into submission. Now, whether McMaster and Tillerson or some of the sage hands surrounding Trump are able to, you know, have a strategy in place or able to give him a way out, you know, we shall see. But, you know, the rhetoric and the tensions and the rhetoric both from Washington and from Pyongyang seems to just go up and up and up.
But if you set aside the rhetoric, though, I mean, there is no new policy from Trump on this. If you're going to be less strategically patient, then you would, for example, impose secondary sanctions. You would kind of try to somehow make an equivalent of the Iran model, even though they're very different situations. You go after any Chinese company that is doing business with North Korea, because that's the lifeline for the regime. If you want to squeeze North Korea, you have to cut off the money. And to cut off the money, you have to go after Chinese companies, and you have to have a confrontation with China and Chinese banks. And no administration has wanted to do that. The Obama administration sometimes, I think, discussed that. But they sort of tried to imply that and in veiled ways threatened China about that. But I don't see the Trump White House ready to do that. And then what else is there? Military action? No, there really isn't any kind of limited military pressure. Some people talk about trying to step up propaganda. You know, good luck with that. Dropping leaflets in North Korea. The other thing I want to say is in Singapore, while Mattis might talk about—
This is at the Shangri-La Summit.
Sorry, yeah. At the Shangri-La Summit, which is every defense minister all over Asia is there, generals everywhere. John McCain is usually walking around. And this is really a different situation, right? At the previous Shangri-La summits, you would have the U.S. Defense Secretary come and talk about the South China Sea, and how, you know, we're concerned about this and we want to see the rule of law and we don't want to see China coercing its smaller neighbors to kind of, you know, seize control or extend its military reach there. No one's going to be talking about the South China Sea really in Singapore. And they'll be talking about North Korea, but mainly behind when the microphones are off, everyone's going to be talking about Trump. And where is the United States on any of these issues? Where are they going? What is Trump's real agenda? Is there an agenda? Is the U.S. no longer a reliable, credible, powerful ally? And should we take matters into our own hands more? Does Japan need to show more leadership? Does Australia need to show more leadership? So it's a kind of echo of what we were seeing in Europe in the NATO summit, where you kind of have this vacuum.
Yeah, Alicia, I wonder how the sort of echoes of Trump's decision not to talk about Article 5 at a speech at NATO headquarters is playing there.
Well, you know, we're sort of a couple days. We're now, what, how many days are we through the news cycle of when he decided to not talk about it? And now we've sort of gone through. We then had, you know, we had Merkel's beer hall comment, and that sort of sparked its own fallout. And we're now a couple days on from that. So there's been a little while for all of this to play out. And yet it's still going, actually, which I think is kind of interesting, because it's amazing. It's been one of the amazing things about the Trump phenomenon to me is, and it just goes to show how sort of ingrained these alliances and this sort of order of things are for policymakers, is that every time, you know, he says something that is, every time he indicates, you know, he's less than 100% thrilled with NATO, it sort of resends shockwaves through the community. So it's still going. I think now we're in the stage of the news cycle where we've all sort of been told to cool our jets about what Merkel said, which I think is basically right.
Remind what Merkel said about the Germany was, what was it, that Germany can no longer rely solely on the UK and the United States?
I'm going to have to pull them up in front of me, but it's something along those lines that in the past few days, she had just come from the G7 summit, and she was saying that Europe's fate is in its own hands. She learned that partners weren't formally former partners weren't as reliable as expected. I don't want to misquote her, but that's the gist of what she said. There's a degree to which we all have to recognize that she's in the middle of an election. These comments were to a certain degree for domestic consumption. You know, her opponent, she seems very poised to win it, but her opponent, if anything, hates Trump far more than she does. But yeah, it's absolutely interesting, no doubt. And the Paris Agreement certainly adds to this sense of, you know, a very dramatic looming fallout between, Europe and the United States. It's really hard to overstate the anger here at the notion that the U.S. might pull out of this. It's really dramatic. I don't know if you, I think it was Sarkozy who said at the time that Trump was elected, when everyone was sort of wondering about the potential consequences for Paris, that if there was a pullout, he would impose a carbon tariff on U.S. imports. His views probably aren't as relevant as he expected them to be at the time, but they're reflective of how angry Europeans really are about this. And I just saw just earlier, a couple hours earlier, that Martin Schulz, who is the Social Democrat candidate for chancellor in Germany, said something similar, that Europe should seek to use its standards as a stick, basically, to ensure that certain clean air standards are met if various countries want market access. So it just the decision today is just adding to a dynamic that's already been in place.
So I wonder if we could pull back the lens, and I think there's a broader issue here that joins the European and Asian questions together, and that is that my experience in government was there was not a single global challenge that we faced where we didn't start with our democratic allies in Europe and Asia as the focal point around which we generated international collective action. ISIS, climate, Ebola, nonproliferation, dealing with a rising China, dealing with a revisionist Russia. Every single national security challenge we face, we started mobilizing the international community by turning to our democratic allies. You obviously saw that our democratic allies in Europe and Asia were extraordinarily nervous about Trump because of the rhetoric during the campaign, which suggested that he was, unreliable, didn't have the right temperament, might abandon them, et cetera. And you saw this concerted effort early in the administration to send people like Mattis and Pence on the road at places like Munich or over to Asia to basically, don't worry about it. Don't worry about the tweets. There are a bunch of adults in the government. Things will basically be a normal Republican administration. And I think what the NATO summit basically suggested was that the adults in the cabinet aren't in charge, right? Because they clearly wanted Trump to do two things. One was to be explicit about Article 5, which he refused to do. Mattis and McMaster wanted Trump to do that. He refused to do that, which suggests that that was either something he felt passionately about or the kind of the Steves, Bannon and Miller, kind of won the argument inside. They also wanted him at the G7 to say something about Paris. They didn't. He obviously didn't do that, and now is signaling quite the opposite. So why would any ally in Europe believe Jim Mattis the next time he gets on a plane and tells them that he speaks for the president? He clearly doesn't speak for the president. And why at Shangri-La would people believe that whatever reassuring words that Jim Mattis has about China, North Korea, or any other issue is actually reflective of the president of the United States? There's a real credibility gap, and it's really damaging to our policy. The last point I would make here is that I don't think we're likely to have a rupture. Like, you're not going to see the collapse of NATO. You're not going to see the disintegration of our alliances in Asia. But what you are going to see is a lot more hedging and drifting. That is, allies who are, hedging against the possibility that the United States might not be there by having slightly closer relationships with Russia in the case of a country like Italy or as it relates to China, some of the countries in ASEAN and in Southeast Asia. So you could start to see hedging and drifting away from the United States. And then the next time the United States faces an international crisis – and people at the State Department, if there ever are any people at the State Department anymore, start picking up phones to get people to make costly decisions to act alongside the United States, people are going to say, like, why do I want to cooperate with Donald Trump? He's toxic. Why would I expose myself to financial costs or political risks at home to cooperate with the United States? Those are the real risks. And I think the listeners should keep in mind, for all of the existential angst we've all had during – not maybe all of us, but many of your listeners, I suspect – during the Trump administration, we've actually not faced a single crisis, a real crisis.
Right.
Everything has been manufactured.
Some manufactured ones, exactly.
You know, it's either been something that's, you know, kind of Kremlin-gate related that's about Trump's behavior or those around him, or it's been the North Korea issue, which has been ginned up as a reason to put pressure on China. We talked about that before. We haven't actually faced an Ebola-like situation or a BP oil spill or a Katrina or, heaven forbid, a Paris-scale terrorist attack here in the United States. And to address any of those issues, at least beyond our shores, we're going to need help. And I'm not sure that people are going to answer the phone.
The one thing I would add is that I think the dramatic reaction to Merkel's comments, you know, one, I think they came about in part because it was a signal that she may no longer see, you know, Trump is kind of a one-off, right? You know, that we all sort of wonder, you know, is Trump just this freak occurrence or is he sort of part of a long-term trend in American foreign policy? And the sort of sign that she thinks that there needs to be some hedging going on, I think, is the signal that, you know, she's making plans for an America that's not going to be reliable, maybe even past Trump. So
it's worth asking a question, too. I was talking to some European diplomats and they were saying, you know, in a way, we've kind of had these discussions and these concerns anyway, even before Trump came along, about, you know, how influential should we allow the U.S. to be, and how responsible should we as Europeans be? And so I'd like to ask the question to everyone, you know, maybe even before Trump became president, wasn't there a situation where U.S. influence and the kind of U.S. reach and global leadership wasn't what it was, that the circumstances have changed, that the world has changed dramatically, China's rise and so on and so forth. And maybe Trump has kind of exposed that in a kind of accelerated, raw way. And maybe this, you know, forces some of our allies to kind of step up more. And maybe we'll see a situation where the U.S. just isn't the automatic, you know, a kind of powerful factor or pillar among democratic countries or among Western countries that it was.
Yeah, it's a great question. I think that look, the tensions between the United States and our closest allies in Europe and elsewhere go back decades, right? I mean, there have been crises in the relationship. There were crises in the 50s, in the 60s, in the 70s, in the 80s, in the 90s, and obviously in the early aughts. I mean, you saw an enormous rift during the lead up and the aftermath of the Iraq War in 2002 and 2003, where obviously the Germans and the French were on the other side of that equation and were very disturbed. I think you saw millions of people in the streets in Europe basically disturbed that that Bush's reaction to 9/11 beyond Afghanistan, where, remember, NATO actually came on our side and triggered Article 5 for the only time in the treaty's history. But with Iraq, most Europeans were very much against that war and believed that this might be the kind of unipolar United States unleashed on the international system in a way that could profoundly undermine European security and global security. So we've seen this a little bit before. They were also, I think, disturbed by a growing disconnect, this kind of Venus-Mars issue that people like Robert Kagan used to talk about on values. And that really manifested itself on things like Guantanamo and torture and climate, Kyoto in particular, and the Bush administration's attitude about that. What Obama did, even in the face of what of some retrenchment, right? There was some retrenchment, obviously, in the Middle East, where our forces came down dramatically in Iraq and eventually in Afghanistan. And people can debate what effect that had on international security or the security of the region. But he was enormously engaged in Europe and made enormous efforts from throughout the administration to try to better align our values, realign our values with our democratic allies. And as a consequence, there was the view of the United States in Europe and Asia went up.
There was a lot of goodwill.
A lot of goodwill. Just look at the Pew data on this. And we got something for that. They signed up on to help us address Ebola. We got the Paris Agreement. We got all these countries into the counter-ISIS coalition. And so I think what they fear now is a little bit of the worst of both Bush and Obama. That is, they fear a kind of swaggering militarism and that you saw from Bush, but disconnected from diplomacy and engagement. They also fear a drift on values like climate and human rights. You saw that kind of the celebration of Trump in the Middle East from autocrats and the wary response from Democrats in Europe, and that is happening in the context of
what they might perceive to be continuing retrenchment, which they may actually see as a continuation from Obama. So it's almost the worst of all worlds, where the United States is less present, less reliable, and less predictable. And that's not a recipe for stability.
Yeah, I want to pivot to the fight against ISIS in Syria here, if we can, just quickly. You know, this is a place where Trump has shown an instinct for militarism. But, you know, there's an Afghan strategy review that is currently ongoing, in which we will probably see a few thousand, if not a few thousand more than that, troops put back into Afghanistan. And then there's been a significant ramp up in the U.S. effort in the fight against ISIS in Syria, including some provocations maybe towards the Iranian regime and towards Assad's forces that we haven't seen before.
Yeah, no, I think it's really worth watching what happens in southeastern Syria in particular. You had something that hadn't happened before. You had U.S. forces actually bombing Iranian-backed militia proxies in southern Syria. And it's not clear. I don't think the Trump administration really has a defined strategy as to what it's trying to do with Iran and Iran's partners on the ground. But it was one of those kind of one thing leads to another kind of situations where, dating back to your time in government, Colin, you know, the U.S. with its partners on the ground in Syria has been pushing ISIS back steadily. And now there's this kind of last urban bastion in Raqqa. Mm-hmm. And as part of that, in kind of the surrounding areas, southwest, you have this kind of small outpost where there's some U.S. Special Operations Forces working with some local forces on the ground that are armed and trained by the U.S. And these Iranian-backed militia got too close, and they were warned. And, we have this deconfliction situation, a mechanism with the Russians where we get on the phone and we tell Russian counterparts, you know, we're going to be doing this here, and please stay away. And the Russians tell us similar things. And those warnings were given, but the Iranian proxies kept coming. And so, you know, the U.S. bombed Iran's proxies in Syria. And this is a very sensitive strategic area. And because ISIS is now losing ground, losing territory, and that creates a kind of grab for territory and opens up a new conflict potentially, where Iran wants to secure areas along the Syria-Iraq border so that it can have its links to Lebanon and the Mediterranean and Hezbollah in Lebanon. And so you can see this kind of collision course potentially, where the U.S. doesn't sit down and say, we want to get into a conflict with Iran in southern Syria, but one thing might lead to another.
So I think what you've got here is you've got the confluence of a bunch of different things. Some of it is just the geography of the conflict, which Dan has pointed to. So the two biggest cities that ISIS has controlled have been Mosul in Iraq and Raqqa in Syria. Mosul is on the brink of being taken back. Now only the old city is there. That will really smash the biggest concentration of ISIS fighters left in Iraq and push them towards the Syrian border. Raqqa is now being encircled largely by a force of Syrian Kurds and associated Arab tribal elements, which we call the Syrian Democratic Forces, that Trump is now arming up for the final push at Raqqa. But there is this other bastion in Syria of ISIS fighters. And as some of them get squeezed out of Raqqa, that's going to grow. And that's in a place called Deir ez-Zor. And this is a place that the regime cares a lot about. They have a little outpost, the Syrian regime. They have a little outpost there. There are also a lot of energy resources, oil and gas in the kind of neighborhood. So it matters. And as Dan alluded to, it's also it's on the way down the Euphrates River Valley toward the Iraqi border. And you have the Iranians who are interested in eventually building a kind of land bridge or corridor that stretches all the way from Iran through Iraq, either the western or northwestern parts of Iraq, into Syria and then on to Lebanon. And so you kind of have this race. You have this race going on where you have U.S.-backed groups coming at Deir ez-Zor eventually from the north and from the south. And you have the Iranians and Iranian-backed groups coming from the east and the west. And you're going to have all sorts of situations in which U.S.-backed forces and Iranian-backed forces, but also U.S. special operations forces that are accompanying these folks in much closer proximity and with rules of engagement where they can schwack these guys if they get too close, which is what happened near this place called Ataf in southeast Syria not too long ago. I don't think that the Pentagon is spoiling for a fight with Iran across the board, but the scenarios under which we could end up seeing events like we saw not too long ago, where we end up taking kinetic action against Iranian actors or their proxies, is going up. And the thing that worries me the most is that this kind of the geography of the battle space is coinciding with a couple of other things. You've got Trump engaged in a strategic review on Iran, which will culminate sometime in the next couple of months. We know that Trump is very hawkish on Iran in general. They don't really want to ditch the nuclear deal, but they want to get much more muscular outside the four corners of the deal against Iran's destabilizing activities. This is actually where the adults in the cabinet agree, right? Mattis, McMaster, they also agree that we need to get have sharper elbows with the Iranians. You have a very impressionable commander-in-chief just back from the Middle East, where he got this hero's welcome, basically, and was completely spun up by both the Saudis and the Israelis on the Iranian threat. You had a speech in Saudi Arabia where Trump basically wrote the Saudis a blank check for their policy across the Middle East, didn't hold them accountable for anything as it relates to the Sunni jihadist threat, and called out Iran as the principal supporter of terrorism in the region. And then last but not least, you have the White House in the midst of an enormous domestic political crisis. And the only time that Trump has ever looked presidential, according to the Beltway bandits on both sides of the aisle, is when he bombed Syria. 59 cruise missiles shot into an Assad airbase in early April. So I worry that the geography of the conflict, the hawkish impulses of the administration, and a president who's in trouble and might be interested in having a fight to distract from his domestic political problems and prove that he's not Putin's poodle, right? Because Iran is aligned with Russia in Syria, that this could all kind of intersect in ways that spin out of control in Syria.
Yeah, let's move a little bit to his domestic problems at home. I mean, this is a president that clearly needs some other enemies or talking points overseas to detract from, you know, Comey. James Comey, the director of the FBI, is going to be testifying next week unless the president tells him not to and invokes an executive privilege, which seems like would be a field day for the press and for everyone.
Almost like giving back the Russian dachas. He'd never do that.
This was in Maryland, right? Yeah. But, you know, maybe he said he'll revoke the or you know, not allow them to have diplomatic immunity in their little fishing enclaves along, what is it, the Choptank River or something. But their subpoenas have been issued to Flynn, to the president's longtime lawyer, Michael Cohen. We've got, you know, Trump granting an ethics waiver to 17 people in the administration, including four lobbyists. So doesn't really look like draining the swamp. And of course, we have the ongoing Mueller investigation into the Russia election hacks and Jared Kushner. So there's a lot swirling around this White House right now.
No, I mean, yeah, exactly. And when he was on that trip, the scandal would not go away. And the revelations are almost daily. So, you know, just before we came on air, like last night, the Washington Post broke the story that the U.S. Is planning to give back those properties where Russian spies dwell. And it's not clear they're getting anything in return. So it feeds these suspicions and these concerns that somehow the Trump White House has some worrisome relationship with Russia. And then the Kushner story was huge while he was traveling. And they have not been able to address that adequately either. And these are becoming less partisan. I mean, you have a lot of Republicans on the Hill that are extremely nervous about this, extremely anxious, often expressed privately. But I mean, it's putting them in an extremely difficult spot because some of their constituents voted for Trump, a good number of them. Some of their constituents actually don't care about some of these revelations, even when they point to potential obstruction of justice. But some of their constituents don't like it, and so they're in a tough spot. And what's interesting is the White House has basically not addressed the whole Kushner story, that he had this
back channel with the Russians. This is family, right? How do you do that? Alicia, this is even reverberating across the pond with Nigel Farage being named a person of interest, I hear.
Yeah, poor Nigel. He's not having the best time. But yes, it seems like he has been, which is pretty interesting. Obviously, you know, Nigel Farage paid that infamous visit to Assange Julian Assange. I don't think we've mentioned him yet, who you know runs WikiLeaks, obviously, and is a crucial player in all of this. He paid a visit to him in the Ecuadorian embassy. There was a much passed around interview with Farage. It was either by Deutsche Welle or by Die Zeit, when a journalist asked Farage about his Russian connections, and Farage basically ended the interview and walked out of the room. So he's becoming increasingly interesting as a figure, but it's hard to know what exactly to make of this yet. There's also, I just want to flag up a recent data point that is again sort of not, it's a little early to be offering a lot of interpretations, but today there was this shift from Putin that was reported on, where he told a bunch of reporters that it's possible that private Russian hackers could have been involved in the cyber attacks and the hacks into the DNC. And that's kind of interesting.
I love the phrase he used. I think he said they're like artists.
They're patriotic artists.
They're patriotic. You never know what these guys are going to do.
Altruistic.
Right.
Maybe Russian hackers are, more free spirited than our hackers. But it's an interesting thing to happen. Again, there's been some interpretation about, maybe he also had said something like he could, imagine that it would be easy enough to build evidence that could link these hacks back to Russia. It would be easy to construct something like that. And it's hard to know what to make of it, but it seems to, hint at something could potentially be coming, either, someone is about to get the blame for this, or that he's worried that some kind of evidence is going to come out and sort of wants to clarify, that these are alternative explanations. And I'm kind of going out on a limb a little bit, but it is an interesting thing that happened today.
So I look, it's the sheer volume of news. So I think, I don't know if, the listeners are a bunch of nerds. So there was a back and forth on Twitter a week or two ago, a bunch of national security nerds who also like science fiction, talking about the Battlestar Galactica episode where the Cylons attack every 33 minutes. And it's just relentless. And that's what the national security news cycle feels like. It's like every 33 minutes, there's a story from the Post or the Times or McClatchy or Reuters or Foreign Policy or wherever that would be an earth-shattering, all-consuming thing for any other administration, but there are like three of them every day. So I think it's hard to keep track. I think I would encourage your listeners to kind of focus on four threads in the next couple of weeks. The first is the first three of them relate to various aspects of possible collusion between the Russians and elements of the Trump campaign. The first being, was there any relationship on the hacking and dissent and leaking of DNC, DCCC, Podesta emails? That's the WikiLeaks angle. That's where Farage and Assange are wrapped up, as is Roger Stone, a close confidant of President Trump, who Trump says he doesn't talk
to
anymore.
Knows
but
him.
But now the New Yorker said the day after Trump says he doesn't talk to him anymore, they talked on the phone. So they clearly talk. And so was there any relationship, collusion, coordination between elements of the Trump campaign and those patriotic hackers or whoever else we know from the intelligence community? They were Russian military intelligence and others to disseminate the information and time leaks in a way that would be politically damaged. So that's one kind of area. The second is whether there were any financial quid pro quos between elements of the Trump campaign and elements of the Russian government or folks close to Putin. And this is actually one of the things that surfaced through all the Kushner stories. It's not just that whether he, wanted to have a secret channel of communication and potentially using the Russian embassy to talk back to the Russians, which is weird. It's not a normal back channel, no matter what H.R. McMaster or
John Allen
or Kelly says about this stuff. But separate from that, Kushner met with this guy Gorkov, who's a senior executive in a Russian bank that's under sanctions because of the Ukraine invasion and annexation of Crimea. And there's some reporting suggesting that the FBI is looking into whether there might have been a financial quid pro quo whereby Kushner would help a Trump administration lift sanctions against Russia in exchange for financing and other things related to business interests. I have no idea if any of that's true, but it speaks to a broader pattern pattern of behavior that people have accused of, you know, the Manafort's of the world and Carter Page, potentially Flynn himself, about whether there were financial kickbacks associated with potential changes in policy, a softening on NATO, a softening on sanctions, and other things that promises were made during the campaign that are now potentially coming to fruition. So that's the financial quid pro quo. The third is the possibility for collusion in the social media space. We know that the Russians engaged in fake news, trolls and bots that bombarded social media networks in the weeks before the election. There were huge spikes in the states that swung the election for Trump, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania. It's not at all clear to a lot of intel analysts why the Russians would understand how to micro-target Bernie voters or African Americans in key districts to try to suppress the vote. And so was there collusion between elements of the Russian government or fronts of the Russian government in this kind of propaganda campaign and elements of Trump? And again, Kushner's name comes back into this equation, as do groups like Cambridge Analytica. I mean, I sound like a conspiracy theory nut. I don't know if any of this is true, but this is why it's so confusing, is that there are the stories that are in all these categories. And the last but not least, and this is where I think the Comey testimony comes in, is there's the obstruction of justice issue. Like, there may actually be no crime, or there may now be no crime that goes all the way up to Trump. Like, it would surprise me quite a bit if some of the underlings don't end up in jail for lying to investigators or for doing things, and Trump may or may not be aware of those activities, but the president himself has engaged in a whole bunch of behavior that I'm not a lawyer, but certainly looks like obstruction of justice. He fired Comey. He admitted because of the Russian investigation. People like Ben Wittes, who are friends with Comey, have suggested that when he couldn't win Comey over and co-opt him, he basically threw him over the side of the ship. Comey himself. People who know Comey or who have leaked to the press apparently on his behalf have suggested that the president told him to stand down from the Flynn investigation. And at least I don't know whether Comey's going to end up testifying or not, but the press reporting the last couple of days suggests that Comey's going to say that Trump asked him to back off. And so even if all of the collusion stuff is BS or it doesn't get anywhere near Trump, there's a cover up here. Or at least that's what it looks like. And so I just think listeners need to kind of parse out as they are bombarded with the daily 5 or 6 p.m. story from the Times or the Post that it gets binned into one of these four categories.
Those are great points.
I was going to say, it is interesting how scandals or fledgling scandals take on familiar patterns, right? And so it's so often the case that it is not the original crime or wrongdoing, but it is how it is handled, covered up, played down, and then maybe even justice obstructed. And we don't know. It's early. And I think it's really important to keep saying we actually don't know what is at the heart of all this. But what is interesting is that the White House manages to feed it themselves constantly, just this story about handing back properties to Russia where Russian intelligence was operating, and those properties were seized because of the meddling in the election. And for nothing in return that at least we know of, nothing really concrete here or substantial, those properties are handed back. Why would you do that now? Yeah. If you're trying to change the subject, why on earth would you? What does the U.S. get out of
it? Why do you meet with Kislyak and Lavrov the day after you fire Comey? No normal administration that actually cares about its image would do things this way, separate and apart from whether there's any criminal or unethical behavior going on.
Right. That's what I mean. So there's kind of like this mess up, screw up factor, or cock up, as they say in London.
I want to just come back to you, Colin, for one thing. I mean, you served in a famously scandal-free administration.
What about the tan suit?
That was
or the gray poupon. Come
that
on,
was
man.
Pretty. The tan suit was pretty awful. That's unforgivable.
The audacity of taupe.
When Obama's been so silent, there was the little bit of a kerfuffle, and perhaps rightly so, over his $400,000 speech, which I think the optics of that were pretty ugly. Does he, I mean, you know the man pretty well, does he speak up if Trump pulls out of the Paris Accords? I mean, this is a legacy issue.
It would surprise me if he didn't say something. I mean, look, he hasn't been completely radio silent. I think that most presidents try to give the next person a bit of a decent interval. I think one of the interesting things is that while that's been true of Obama, there are a lot of former Obama officials who were quite active right away in criticizing the Trump administration. That may be a byproduct of technology and the way in which the news cycle operates, or just how freaked out we all were by the Trump administration.
Nerds, this is a plug for our shadow government blog.
Roger that. But look, I mean, the president's come out and said some things on immigration issues. You know, interestingly, he was in Berlin meeting with Merkel just before Trump went to the NATO summit and met with Merkel, and those optics could not have been any different, right? Obama was met in Germany as a rock star. 70,000 people showed up to see him just have a TED-style interview conversation with Merkel. He was kind of met with all this adoration, and he said a lot of things about how we can't build walls and we have to stay true to our values. And he never, you know, says the word Trump, but I think it's pretty clear what he's talking about. So, look, these are things that I've not interacted with President Obama at all since he's left office. But these are obviously things that he believes passionately in, and that he and his administration invested a lot in. So, on these issues that matter a lot for the future, I suspect we'll hear more and more from him. But that he'll largely frame it as he has in terms of general values and principles and interests, as opposed to. And then let people figure out that who he's criticizing.
And what about your other former boss, Vice President Biden? He seems more willing to say things.
Well, you know,
that's always been
the
case.
So this is interesting. So Biden used to say all the time, look, my problem is not that I say what I mean. It's that I say everything I mean. So the vice president has been on the road a lot, giving a lot of commencement speeches. And I think that's created a platform for him to make the argument. I think he's really been trying to make kind of two arguments. One is that As down as a lot of us are, our best days are still ahead of us, and we need to keep that in mind. That you know, he talks about his experience during the 1960s, and you had assassinations and riots and the Vietnam War and the civil rights movement. Like, it felt like the Republic was kind of being ripped apart, and we got through that. We'll get through this again. And part of it is to stand up for the same types of values issues that you know, I talked about just a second ago with Obama. But I just think he's been out there a lot.
Well, I think we've been out there a lot. This has gone quite long. We've almost hit two Battlestar Galactica news cycles now. So thank you, ER Nerds, for sticking with us. And I want to thank Colin, Dan, and Alicia for being with us today. We'll see you all again soon. You've been listening to Foreign Policy's The ER Podcast. I'm Ben Pauker, and I've been your host. The program is produced by Maria Ori. For more information about FP and to subscribe to the ER and our Global Thinkers and Backstory podcasts, please visit foreignpolicy.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks very much for joining us.